To progressive reformers in the first quarter of the 20th century, the archenemies were the oil companies, public utilities, and the railroads.
People knew that the Pennsylvania Railroad controlled New Jersey state politics in Trenton.
Political scientist Richard Connors.
We were trying to get deals on taxes.
Haig made sure they paid their fair share of taxes. And in doing so, this machine politician gained a reputation as a local Robin Hood.
So this became then very naturally a whipping boy for Frank Haig.
The whipping boy was also a golden goose. The railroads gave Frank Haig the means to finance his elaborate patronage system, city jobs which the Haig organization dispensed. But contrary to popular belief, these jobs did not lift the Irish into the middle class. They were generally low-wage, blue-collar jobs, and 85 to 90% of Jersey City workers were not on the Haig payroll. However, the Haig organization did give the Irish political power and pride.
The organization was a sacred word. The word machine was never used.
Tom Fleming, whose father was a ward leader under Haig.
I never heard my father say the word Haig machine. That was an insult. A machine implied that there was some kind of a cold, automatic process that we just ground out the votes. An organization implied there was this hierarchy from the top down, all these different people with different levels of importance, different duties, different responsibilities, and most of them Irish. They were triumphing as a people after two centuries of humiliation in Ireland.
Frank Haig's organization was structured like political machines of the day in Chicago, New York, Boston, Kansas City, Memphis. The key person was the ward leader. In Jersey City, there were 13 wards.
A ward leader was City Hall's representative in this patch of urban geography. He had a group of people who worked for him. He had his own team. You know, the ward was divided up into districts, and each district had a district leader. And he, in turn, had people who worked for him. And a lot of these people worked for the city. Not all, but quite a few. And then all the cops and the firemen in the ward, when they wanted a promotion, they went to the ward leader. Everything that happened politically in the city went through the ward leader. He also had the power to delegate who was going to have the numbers games in the ward, who was going to have the a certain number of card games, who was going to pick up a horse race betting, the ward bookie. All these guys were his appointees. They were loyal to him, and in turn, they all paid off to him. So each month, my father would collect thousands of dollars from these people, and he would deliver it all to City Hall. He hardly ever took any money from this. This was because he had an understanding with Haig. When Haig went in, put him in, he said, "Now I want one thing: no clipping. You got it. We need all the money we can get to run the organization, to run the state party and so forth. You know, Jersey City was the funding source for all this stuff." And he says, "We need it all, and I don't want you to be taking any." And that's all there is to it.
The money rolled in, and the ward leader delivered it to City Hall. But most important was delivering the votes. That was the ward leader's primary job. On election day, he commanded an army of campaign workers. Again, Tom Fleming.
There was a fleet of cars at his disposal, which he would get from private citizens, and also he'd put his car and other cars from the county garage, and they would get anybody who was at least breathing to the polls. There was never any excuse to allow someone to say, "Oh, you know, I just broke my ankle, I can't vote." No, there'll be a car there in 10 minutes and we'll take you to the polls. There were cars to take the nuns from the Catholic schools to the polls. The ward leader saw in the weeks before the election that every single person in his ward had a personal visit, a canvass it was called. every single person in his ward had a personal visit from one of his representatives, either the district leader himself or one of his assistants in the district. My father often talked about Tammany Hall, which was supposedly the great machine of the era, you know. Actually, Tammany was on its uppers in the Hague era, you know, in the 20s and the 30s. But the people in Jersey City laughed at Tammany. They regarded them as sort of weary, worn-out guys who didn't know how to do it anymore. They didn't canvass. My father used to say in an appalled tone, they don't canvass. I mean, that was like saying that a pilot didn't have a license or something like that to fly the plane. I mean, this was so basic in Jersey City. To get that vote out, you got a visit. That's all there was to it. And if you didn't want to vote or you had to make an explanation of some sort. And the guy was ready with an answer, you know, about the issues or just plain loyalty. Very often, look, your brother-in-law is on the cops, and you know, it would really help if you voted, because that gets back to City Hall that he's got a brother-in-law that doesn't vote, or God forbid, votes Republican.
After each election, Haig rated each ward leader by the turnout in his district. This could enhance the ward leader's power, as did the take from gambling. Haig had another source of funds that didn't depend on the ward leader. It was the infamous 3%. Everyone who got a city job paid 3% of his income each year directly to City Hall.
The 3% was known as rice pudding.
Again, Jersey City historian Bob Leach.
They got that term from an old 1890s term when there were nickel beers. A bar customer would have a bunch of nickels on the bar counter, and when the barman wiped up with the rag, he would accidentally scuff up a little of those extra nickels, and that was known as rice pudding, that illicit tip that the barman would take for himself. There was various viewpoints on it. My mother always said she'd be glad to pay the 3% if only her husband could get a job with the Haig machine. Others, particularly, I had an uncle who resented he was a cop. The policemen resented paying it because, well, they felt we really do something. We're out here working. Let the political hacks pay the 3%. But he built a very strong machine in that way. And the other remarkable thing about it is up until Haig came along, there had been bossism in Jersey City. We had boss Bob Davis. But Bob Davis always broke deals with the factory owners and the bankers, and that's where he received his financing from, his rice pudding, we'll call it. But Haig would brook no deals with bankers or factory owners. It was us against the world, us against them, and it was in this way that he developed this 3% system. And if you think about it, it is rather remarkable. Haig was not indebted to the bank or the broker. He was indebted to the people, the common people who finance his machine.
Oh, people did resent it. I mean, it was one of the things when he was overturned that people talked about a lot.
Historian Barbara Petrick.
His 3% obligation. Looked at from another point of view, was a political contribution. I mean, I don't know of any office holder now who doesn't look for campaign contributions. Isn't that what the courts have called freedom of the speech or something, that corporations can give millions, for heaven's sake, for their interests? All Haig was asking for was a little sign that you thought he was doing a good job. And he just quantified it. 3% made it, you know, you knew what was expected. In a way, it was kind of fair, you know, because everybody had to pay the same.
City workers paid their 3% not because they felt it was fair, but because they knew the consequences if they didn't. Again, Thomas Fleming.
My mother had a very close friend who's been a fellow school teacher with her, and she was married to a man named Walter Farrelly. Walter was a very nice man. I knew him quite well, and he was a reader. He wasn't tremendously well educated, but he was better educated than, you know, most of the people in the Haig organization, that's for sure. And he didn't like the system at all. He was a fireman, so he decided he wouldn't pay his 3%. And he also went around to various bars and said that Frank Haig was a bum and a tyrant and this and that. Well, the next thing you know, Marie was on the phone saying, "Oh," to my mother, "oh, boo hoo hoo hoo, oh, they're being so mean to Walter." Walter got what they called, I forget the exact term for it now, but it was the moving treatment, let's call it. He would be ordered to pack up all his gear and move from his firehouse to another firehouse on the other side of town. He would get to that firehouse, just be unpacked, which would, you know, quite, the fireman lived in the firehouse, so he had a lot of stuff with him. And then he would get another order to move to another firehouse on the opposite end of town. And he would get there, and the next day, or maybe even in the next hour, he would get an order to move to another part of town. And so my mother rushed to my father, oh, you can't let them do this to Walter. And my father went to see Walter, and Walter suddenly understood that maybe it was a good idea to pay the 3%, and Walter didn't have any moving troubles anymore.
Exactly how the 3% was delivered to the Hague machine has been lost to history. But Jersey City historian Bob Leach knows the name of the bagman.
There was a fellow by the name of Needle Nose Malone, and that was Hague's deputy mayor. In later years, he would actually run the town because Hague was absent a lot. Hague would travel. Hague would be gone for months. He'd be in Paris. He'd be on a cruise. And on a particular day, I believe it was in April, I don't know the day for sure, you were to deliver a bag of money to Needle Nose, 3% of your annual salary. Needle Nose had a safe. It was kept in a safe down in City Hall. There was no accounting. There was no receipt for it.
And thus, no way to know where all that money ended up or how much Frank Hague pocketed. It was all cash. Thomas Fleming.
I had an uncle named Billy Black who was in the tax department at City Hall. And Billy was a very somewhat naive man, very good man. And one day Hague gave him a suitcase and told him to get on the Hudson Tubes and go to New York. And it was a pretty heavy suitcase. And it was not much of a suitcase. It was an old battered thing, you know. And he said, you go to this brokerage house, give it to this guy. You go to this bank, give it to this guy. You go to this other brokerage house, give it to that guy. You know, he had a whole list of addresses. And Billy noticed that each place he went, when he got the suitcase back, it was a little lighter. And then, and so forth. And he finally came back to City Hall, and he went up to the mayor's office and gave Hague the empty suitcase. And he said, what was in that thing? And Hague said, money, you idiot. See, to give that suitcase to a guy, not even tell him there was money in it, that's nerve. They ran the organization on that kind of nerve. They didn't have a great deal of respect for the law, let's put it that way. They had seen the law being abused and misused when they were young against them, you know, no Irish need apply signs and stuff like that. So they didn't have a great, they weren't raised with a lot of respect for the law, and they ran the organization more or less along that line.